everyone, and welcome to Teach Me Teacher, a podcast for educators where we, the teachers, become students ourselves. I'm your host, Jacob Chastain, and today it is my pleasure to bring you Susan Zakowitz of Brockton fame, Brockton High School. We're going to talk about educational leadership and what it really takes to create lasting change on a campus. Alrighty, Sue, how are we doing today?
I am doing great, Jacob. Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to chatting.
You know what? I've been looking forward to this episode because you came down to our district, Birdville ISD, not too long ago.
Right.
And gave this fantastic speech to all of these administrators.
Oh, thanks.
And you know what I really loved about you is you're like, in the description of Teach Me Teacher on iTunes, we say we're a no-nonsense podcast, and that's what you are. Like, you're a no-nonsense leader. You're just like, let's get it done.
You have to be. You just can't, you know, there's no time to dance around things, and you guys were great. I really enjoyed that, and I've been in Texas a lot because there's been a real strong focus on literacy, and you know from, you know, what I talked about, that's what made the change in Brockton. So, you know, I think everybody's on the right track. I think it's awesome.
Yeah. And literacy is, you know, it's this huge thing, and it's really cool to see it from my end because, you know, I'm getting my master's in curriculum and educational leadership. So I'm not there yet, but I'm an ELA teacher, and I've been, you know, I love researching like tons of people on our podcast have been like the leading educators in ELA. We had Jeff Anderson on, who we just released a podcast with him, and Donalyn Miller and all these other guys who are really kind of at the forefront of literacy education. And that's kind of, it's just been cool to see our district kind of latch on to these ideas and go, okay, well, obviously this needs to be our focus because it literally affects everything else.
It does. It does. And it shouldn't be about ELA. It's like, since when is literacy just about English class? It should be in all classes. And I think that's what, you know, that I always say there's no magic bullet or secret sauce or, you know, whatever it takes to improve schools, but getting everybody on the literacy focus makes a big difference for the kids. No question about it.
Yeah. And you know what, that's a perfect segue into kind of what you did and where, you know, that Brockton fame came from. So let's go ahead and lead into that. For anyone who doesn't know who you are,
okay,
what would be your elevator pitch that you would give them to kind of give a background about who you are and what you did?
Well, I mean, it's a really easy story to tell. First of all, I grew up in Brockton, and I went to the Brockton Public Schools, and I graduated from Brockton High, and I came back to teach my whole career at Brockton High. I was a history teacher, and then I moved into administration. And what happened at Brockton High was the city was struggling, the schools were in trouble, we were, and you know what? We're the Brockton Boxers, and so I was a proud Brockton Boxer, and it hurt that we were doing so badly. And finally, what happened? The real sort of where we really realized we had to do something was when Massachusetts implemented a high stakes exam that all kids needed to pass to graduate. And we at Brockton High had a 75% failure rate. And we ended up on the front page of the Boston Globe as one of the worst schools in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And it was embarrassing. And it was, and for me, it was personal, Jacob. I went there. And so, you know, people can blame a they can say, oh, well, the test stinks or whatever it is. But you know what? Every other school didn't have a 75% failure rate. So here we were.
Yeah.
So we had to do something, and we had to do it fast because our kids wouldn't be earning a diploma. So as I told you guys when I was in your district, we made a mistake first. We tried to chase the test. You know, we analyzed the test and we did this ridiculous Shakespearean experience. And, you know, that was the worst course to take because you can't, school improvement, it's student improvement can't be about a test. It has to be about what the skills kids need. So we took a step back from that when that didn't work. And we said, what are the skills our kids need to be successful on the state exam, in their classes, and in their lives beyond school. And when we answered those three questions, we got to the sweet spot of literacy. And the way we defined literacy was that all kids needed to learn a set of skills in four areas: reading, writing, speaking, and reasoning, or thinking, but we called it reasoning because we felt that was a little more analytical. And our focus, Jacob, was really to, it wasn't about so much about teaching the kids first as much as teaching the teachers first. How can we teach these kids the skills they need? And that became the core of what we did. And we started, when I talk about we, it was a team of teachers and administrators who came together and said, we can do this. And we started asking ourselves, how do we teach first of all, what are the skills kids need? And then how do we do it? Because I probably told you this story when I was with you in the district, but for me, I was a history teacher. You're an ELA teacher. You have some skills in teaching kids reading and writing that I was never taught. I didn't know how to teach reading. Here's how I taught. I would use a primary source in history, and I taught reading by saying, when the kids would say, oh, Miss, this is hard, I'm like, oh, okay, then I need to teach. So you just read it again. And you just keep reading it again and again and again. And that's not effective.
Yeah.
But the key for that lesson, it's not that I was a bad teacher. I wasn't. I just didn't know how. So our real secret sauce was we started teaching ourselves how to teach these literacy skills to all kids in every class. And that became it was a school-wide initiative, Jacob, that changed everything. So that's the sort of elevator speech. All of a sudden we went from being one of the lowest performing schools in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to outperforming districts that were affluent, and you know, and we started getting all kinds of recognition, and that was way cool because, you know, the kids knew when they were on the front page of being called a failing school. One newspaper called us an educational cesspool. Another called us a dropout factory. Kids heard that message, and when the governor and the commissioner of education were coming back and saying to the kids, "You are a school of champions," the kids were. They knew. And so it was the right way to go for us. It was all about literacy.
Yeah. And you know what? You mentioned something that has kind of been a reoccurring theme on the podcast because we talk about, you know, public education. So the thing that comes up a lot is testing.
Right.
And your comment briefly, you know, people are like, oh, well, you can just sit there and blame the test. But yeah, I mean, a test can be terrible. But if you're right at the bottom of the terrible test.
What does that say? You got that. You got that right. Well, and testing can be terrible, but it can also be really helpful. A good, mm-hmm. You know, when you start looking at what kids were like, we had to take a step back from blaming. And by the way, I meant blaming ourselves too. It wasn't about blame. It was about looking at it with a fresh set of eyes and saying, what are the skills that are being measured on this test? And guess what they were? They were reading skills. Kids need that in life. They were writing skills. Kids need that in life. So it wasn't that the test, now, not that I agreed with every question. Of course, there were some lousy questions on the test.
Sure.
But for the most part, the test was around a set of standards that our kids really should have been able to handle, and they couldn't. So it was really a wake-up call for us to say, you know, we need to really think about what we're teaching, how we're teaching it, but most importantly, how do we know the kids are learning it? Because, you know, teachers would often say, as I did, well, I don't know, I taught it. But you know, we weren't really good at looking at how do we know the kids are learning it. So it was a wake-up call for us. And it wasn't all about blaming a test. You have to get past that because, you know, tests can really, it's not the be-all, end-all to what education should be. It should never be that. But it is an important measure of equity and what kids need to know and be able to do. So we stopped the blame game and went around, you know, and said, well, what can we do and what can we do better? And what do our kids need? And that was huge for us.
I mean, that's a really powerful statement because we've all sat in a group of educators or a group of professionals or a group of adults of any kind, and everyone just sits there and we go, well, it's because of this reason we can't do it. Right. I'm like, okay, well then let's all go home then. Right. You know, it's like, what are you doing? Like we can't, that literally leads you nowhere.
Right. And it's no good for the kids.
Yeah. And you know what? Like the idea of standardized testing, you know, there's beliefs on all spectrums, but it's essentially like the way you guys looked at it was you examined the skill set rather than the questions and rather than very specific things. Well, you did that at first and then you evolved to the skill set or you evolved to what skills do they need? Do they need to be able to read? They need to be able to analyze. They need to be able to do all these things. And I think that, and that's not teaching to the test.
No, it was not. Like I said, we tried that approach first. And that's just crazy because that becomes a narrow guessing game. What do you think is going to be on the test next year? You know, that was crazy.
Yeah.
We broadened the perspective and said, there are a set of skills in reading because our kids, we knew it, Jacob, they didn't know how to break down, especially nonfiction. It's tough. There's a level of vocabulary that's challenging for them. And it's just never easy to plow through that. And so, but there are techniques that kids can apply that help them. And it didn't just help them on the MCAS test in Massachusetts or the SAT or the ACT. You know, one of our students in a documentary about PBS did a documentary about our school, and they talked to kids, and one of the kids said, you know, when they first started doing this, you didn't think you'd use these. You thought it was about the test. And she said, but now I'm a senior and I'm going to college and I use these skills all the time. I didn't think I would. And I do. And it helps. And that, I think, is the best way to look at it. It's about a skill set that everybody needs to know to be successful. It's sort of those skills we do in life. And how do you teach those? And that was really the hardest point for us, is figuring out how do we teach these skills to the kids. And that worked. And that was where our literacy workshops came from, where the literacy workshops weren't for the students. They were for us, the teachers.
Yeah.
And it was teachers teaching teachers. We wrote our own literacy workshops and taught them to each other. And we did it instead of having faculty meetings where somebody just makes some announcements and, you know, and it's not a productive use of time. We said, let's take our faculty meetings and make them literacy workshops. And we really tackled best practices in teaching literacy across every classroom. So kids were learning reading and writing skills and not just English, but math and science. And yet the subject was the context. I mean, obviously in science, if you're a science teacher and you're teaching about, you know, volcanoes, you pick a reading and some questions and writing about that topic. It was always content. The content provided the context, but it really was about teaching the kids the skills they needed to break down a reading. How do I comprehend this? How do I work through this? And then write about it and talk about it and think about it. All those things that we do as adults.
So when you're, you know, there's so many things I want to jump on, but I do want to take a step back and get to your, you know, the role as a principal, because change is one of these things that scares the crap out of people.
Oh, please. Yes.
You're not talking about simple change. This isn't like, hey, everyone, we're going to make sure kids don't wear hoodies, right? This is...
Oh, right. No, this was about changing teaching practices.
Yeah.
It was hard.
So as a principal, you know, how did you approach this idea to everyone? Did you just sit everyone down and say, all right, this is what we're doing? Or like, did you ease them into it? What was kind of your process on how to take all of these teachers out of their comfort zone?
Well, and that is, I think, the best question you can ask. I really do, because it is really the essence of how do you move. Change is so scary for people, and rightly so. I mean, I don't think anybody, you know, you do what you do in the classroom and you do it well. And so you're nervous about asking, you know, oh my God, I'm being asked to do something I've never done before. So here's, you know, and it's a great question about how do you can't just impose change, because that's not going to take hold either. So here was really the and it's about systems. Here was really the systems we used. And I keep saying we, because I don't think any principal can be the Lone Ranger. Yeah. And no principal can do anything alone. It takes a team. And so we had a team of teachers and administrators. We called ourselves a restructuring committee, but whatever whatever leadership team you have and you call yourselves. And so we then, here's what I think teachers need before they just jump into change. By the way, I say this having been a teacher for 40 years and knowing that I was, a lot of times nothing was explained to me. You know, why are we doing this? Oh, no, the administration said we have to. That is the worst way to implement. So here's what I think we needed to do. We first needed to explain why is this necessary. And so before we leaped into literacy, we spent a couple of meetings of engaging teachers in looking at things that the skills kids needed. We asked teachers to talk about what are the skills kids need to be successful in your class? What are the skills kids? So we were all talking in a common vocabulary. That's still not enough, by the way, but that got the conversation going. So teachers need to know, first of all, why are we doing this? Secondly, they need to be engaged in the process. Teacher voice was critical to what we were doing. It wasn't just this voice from on high saying, and now we go down the road of literacy, because that's just going to send people off the deep end. So we based it on research. And by the way, not just it was our research, but it was also good research in the field, what do kids need. Literacy is a strong message about success and what kids need. And so why are we doing this? Here's my voice in this. What do I think needs to be done? And teachers were engaged in the whole process. So I think while there were people who were resistors, Jacob, and I'll be happy to talk about that in a second, most people would tell you that at Brockton, they were included in the process. And it was teachers teaching teachers. We didn't just, you know, I often say when I probably said this when I was presenting, you know, too often educational change is done externally, you know, like bring in the outside person, like a Navy SEAL leaping through the roof to save the day. And, you know, we can't do that. We need to save the day. So our Brockton teachers were teaching our Brockton teachers. It wasn't this, you know, we used the research and the help from other people, of course, because people would, you know, I don't believe it. I think we don't have to reinvent the wheel. Let's look at what's out there. But we really kept teachers engaged. And I guess the other thing, I thought, why are we doing this? How am I engaged in it? I think thirdly, a principal needs to be very clear about what it is. Because I think I was one of those teachers that would say to you, please just tell me what you want me to do because I'm not following you. You know, so be very clear. Like we said, we're going to start with writing and these are the steps we're all going to use. I think teachers feel better about that. Okay, now I get what you want. And then the last thing I'd say is it needs to be monitored because it is ultimately, even though I'm talking a lot about teachers, the final measure of this is what happens with the kids. So monitoring that this is done, and I don't mean monitoring in a negative, punitive way. I mean making sure what's supposed to be happening is happening, and do we need to change it? Do we need to revise it? And that's where the teacher voices are important. But it still didn't always go smoothly, Jacob. It didn't. That yeah. Sounds like an easy way to talk through the process, but that doesn't mean it went smoothly all the time.
You mentioned, you know, this idea of monitoring, and I think a lot of people, you know, when we're said, oh, you know, when we're told, oh, you know, we're going to come check this, we're going to come monitor right. this, there's a way that educational leaders can do that, and it right. seems very punitive, like you said, but when it comes to initiatives that you actually believe in, that yeah. monitoring is something you want to happen because you want to know, hey, is what we're all using all of this time for effective?
Exactly. And you're like, exactly right.
So
exactly.
When you're talking to teachers, though, when you're relaying that, hey, we're going to monitor this, mm-hmm. how do you advise telling teachers that in a way that doesn't make them feel like they're pressured, because,
right.
you know, there's tons of situations, and I felt this before too, where it's like, oh, well, you know, they're watching it, so I'm going to yeah. try to, you know, make it look very specific, you right. know, when they're around, so it'll get in trouble or something like that. But really, like, that kind of defeats the entire purpose of the scenario. But that's a...
Exactly. Exactly.
So how do you keep that fear right. out of this entire process as one of the leaders of it?
Right. It's a great question. And let me actually answer that using a really specific example that's almost like what you just described. I think as people, we're all nervous about trying something new. That's, mm-hmm. you know, oh my God, if I do this the first time, am I going to look like a fool? Am I going to do it right? I don't want to do it wrong. So when we started, we were very clear about what we were going to do. We trained everybody. We didn't start anything till everybody had been taught. We started with writing. And we trained the whole faculty in a writing process that we were all going to use. Now, again, people would use their own content area, of course, but it was always about that we're all going to follow the same steps. Now, we came in, we did monitor. However, here's what happened. Just what you said, Jacob. Teachers were nervous because we were coming in as administrators. And so now... And what do we have, like a little checklist? Now, if that doesn't make you nervous, I can't imagine. You know, so now an administrator is standing in your room with a clipboard.
It's always the checklist.
So I got a call from, and at this point, by the way, I was the associate principal when all this started, and then became the principal the next year. But so anyway, but still, that's a, you know, so here I am, the associate principal, standing in your room with a clipboard and a checklist. So I got a call from the union president. Massachusetts has a teachers union and all of that. And it was a great conversation we had, because he said to me right away, he said, Sue, he said, I'm not calling because I'm opposed to this. So I don't want you to, you know, be upset. And he said, but teachers are calling me saying they're nervous that they're trying something they've never done before and they're being evaluated. And you know, Jacob, that resonated with me, because I would be that teacher. Mm-hmm. I would be that person that saw you in the back of the room with your clipboard and checklist and say, oh, what are you writing? I want an A. You know, like, what? You know, you want to make sure you're doing it right. So I said to the union president, whose name was Tim, I said, Tim, I get that, and you're right. And I, so here's the kind of thing that can help. What we did was we said, we gave the teachers the walkthrough tool that we were using, which, by the way, only had two things on it. Is this working? What do we need to do better? You know, no, it wasn't a teacher evaluation tool. And we also said, listen, none of these walkthroughs for this will be used for personnel evaluation in any way. And right away, everybody's tension went down, because we said, we're looking at monitoring the initiative. We know things are going to go wrong. We've never done this before. And so we actually had a whole faculty meeting where we talked to the teachers about that, so that they knew that if they blew something, okay. It wasn't even that they blew it. That's even the wrong expression to use. That if you were struggling through the steps with your class, that's okay. We maybe needed to revise the steps. So we kept it, and then after every implementation, we had a faculty interdisciplinary discussion group, small groups, where we asked the faculty to evaluate what we were doing, what worked well, what needs to be revised, what should we do next time. And so everybody felt like they weren't being, and not everybody, I'm sure there were still people that were nervous and all that. Nothing is ever 100%. But by the fact that we took it off the personnel observation and evaluation, people right away went, phew, you know, and it was a good way of doing it. And yet, I will say this, it was still monitored and mandated with when you had to do something. Like, we didn't leave it to chance. They had to do it. And they were okay with that. And if they weren't, we met about it, you know, so there was some people that still resisted. But for the most part, no teacher wants their students to be failing. I mean, so if they were willing to give it a try. And in fact, one teacher even said to me, he wasn't on board, but he said, you know what? I'm a science teacher, and what really resonates with me is evidence, and we have the evidence that this is working. So I think the monitoring became less about their own personnel file and more about what the process was. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense, because we, you know, those evaluations, like I happen to be a teacher who I'm really comfortable people being like, I love being watched. I'm kind of, you know, I love attention. I mean, come on, I made a podcast, for God's sakes. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, like, I'm not against this process of being seen and being heard and stuff, but tons of people feel uncomfortable about that. And tons of people feel uncomfortable when it comes down to their evaluations. They don't want to mess with their evaluations. Right. And I mean, that's a perfect process.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So that really helped with, you know, with how people felt that they weren't, it sort of took the personal out of it and made it more about the school-wide literacy initiative. And that helped a lot.
So how did you get buy-in for this, this push towards literacy? And then, we'll talk about how you selected literacy next, but I want to figure out how you got this buy-in, because I've seen so many initiatives roll out in just the 4 years I've been at this school, and there's not always buy-in, and sometimes there's a lot less buy-in than people think. And then, you know, and where did you guys start getting teachers onto this?
Right. And you know, that's the best, that's the question I'm asked most. How did you get everybody to buy in? And the truth of that answer is you don't have everybody ever. And you want to, but you don't. And I would answer it this way, and then I'll be more specific. If we waited for buy-in from everybody, we'd still be waiting. Let me answer the how do you get buy-in in two ways. The first part to that question is you get buy-in by engaging people in the process and making them feel that it's not being done upon them. We're all in this together. And why? Why are we doing this? Making sure it's clear why that this is important and why we need to do this. So I don't think the why is any small thing. And I think far too often in my career as a teacher, that wasn't explained to me. You know, why are we doing this? What are we doing? Why are we doing? No, that wasn't part of the conversation. So partly it's making the mission clear and why, and engaging teachers. But my second part of that answer, and I don't ever want to sound disparaging to teachers, because first of all, I was one. That was what I did most of my career. The longest part of my career was as a classroom teacher. But we wouldn't be where we were as a school without teachers. But I will say this. We had a small handful of people that not only did not buy in, but they resisted. And so the second part of my answer is, for those people, sometimes this is going to sound negative to say, but it's the truth of the matter. Sometimes initially it needs to be mandate and monitor for those people that aren't going to do it, because you can't opt out of teaching literacy. It's too important. So for people that didn't buy in, we tried all the positive things. We met with them. We supported them. We explained everything. I always believe in the positive way of approaching things. But let me give you a real example. There was, I might have shared this one, but there was an art teacher in our school, and he didn't believe in this. And he just wanted the kids to be painting. And by the way, you can do a great literacy lesson using the work of artists. Yeah. Why does the artist choose a particular subject? Why do artists write about their work? So there was plenty of material, but he just was against it. So when we were doing this, he mocked it to the kids. Like he said in his class, first of all, he covered up all the literacy objectives with student artwork. So you couldn't even see the reading objectives. I know, it was awful.
That's so funny.
I know, and it's just a small, I don't ever want to make it seem like it's a lot of people. It isn't, but leaders may face this. You know, somebody thinks, I don't have to do this. Who is this person to tell me what to do? I'm an art teacher. Well, my feeling about that is, it was precisely the electives that were more powerful, because, you know, I said to him at one point, the kids would follow you off a cliff. You know, if you tell them how important good reading is and good writing is, it's going to mean more than to them if their English teacher says something. So we all need to contribute. So anyway, he also mocked the writing assignment and said to the kids, we're going to do this quickly because I have to, but then I'm going to get through it fast so we can get to the real work of the class. Now, that's just insubordinate, and it's the wrong thing to do, and it sends a bad message. So in those kind of cases, we had to have a behind-closed-door discussion. And by the way, I like this guy. He and I worked well together for many, many years. And but it had to be one of those meetings where you said, I'm going to tell you what I heard. And if I went down to your room, would I see the literacy objectives displayed or would I see them covered up? And he was like, well, there might be a few papers that are over them, you know. And I asked him if he had, how he had done things. And, you know, he said, well, I don't really remember saying that. So in that case, unfortunately, that had to be a more prescriptive way of doing it. And I said to him, here's what we're going to do. You need to do this. It wasn't an angry meeting. It was just a very factual, matter-of-fact, straightforward meeting. I said, you're going to do this again, and I'll be there to help you. And he said, well, I don't need your help. And I said, well, I don't think you do either, but I'm going to be there just in case you do. So, you know, unfortunately, that was one of those times. Now, again, that's not most people, because most people got on board because they saw results. The best way to get people on board is to get results. But I will say for all of those, you know, the people, the teacher leaders that you have, and you have so many in your district, you're going to face resistance whenever you try to do something new. And the best way to deal with it is to start off in the most positive way, to explain what's going on. But the bottom line is, if something's so important to the success, you can't let people opt out. They need to be on board. And so sometimes it just has to be a because I said so moment. Not the way you want to do it and not the way it happens most often, but sometimes it just has to be that way. This, you know, you said it at the beginning, the no-nonsense approach, Jacob. That's what it had to be sometimes.
All right, guys, that is the end of part one with Susan Zekowitz. And I got to tell you, I am in love with this interview. Sue is a phenomenal educational leader. She's a phenomenal person. Everything she says with strength and power and knowledge. And it's what we said in the podcast. It is that no-nonsense approach to education that I love so much. All the people that I look up to in education are these types of people. They're the people who get stuff done because they're confident in what they know needs to get done, and they guide people to either see their way or collaborate to make it something better. And I just can't speak highly enough for that type of leader, specifically Sue. Part two is so, there's so much in part two. I had trouble editing where to cut the two parts. You are getting so much content these 2 weeks, because Sue and I, the interview in total is about an hour and a half. So there is so much more to come in part two, and I can't wait for you guys to hear it. I hope you are enjoying this episode as much as I did. I just kept stopping as I was listening and editing this episode for the week, and I was just writing down all, you know, her one-liners, her quotes, everything that just stuck with me. And I was just nodding my head, just saying, yes, 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 specifically about the stuff about literacy. Because as you guys know, if you've been listening to the podcast for any amount of time, I'm a literacy guy. That's what I do. That's my camp. I'm an ELA teacher. But literacy is powerful. It is the gateway to our students' minds, reading and writing. It shows us what's happening inside of their brains. It allows us to connect to them. Reading and writing have a very unique perspective on our students and for us as well. And I think it's just so important for us to have this conversation about why it should be in every classroom, why it shouldn't just be us ELA teachers talking about it, and why everyone needs to have these elements within their stuff. Brockton High School did it, and we're going to learn more about that process on how they were able to revolutionize their school in part two. So stick around for that. For everything else, ladies and gentlemen, go to teachmeteacherpodcast.com where you can get every episode without any hassle of subscribing anywhere. But if you would love to have us be downloaded directly to your device of choice, go to iTunes, hit that subscribe button, hit that review button, drop us a couple stars if you would like, leave us a review, let us know how we are doing. I've said this a million times, those reviews and those star ratings help other teachers find us. And right now, we are being found by so many people in so many areas of the world, and I can't tell you how thankful I am for those of you who have gone out there, used your time to support the podcast. It is phenomenal what you educators do. I want to empower you guys. I want to keep doing this for you. Every review, every star click is just one more day, one more week, one more month, one more year. I get to bring you guys the best in the business to give you that teacher affirming message that you know Teach Me Teacher is all about. Until next week, everyone, have a good one.